all, welcome everybody. We're excited to have you on for tonight's call. It won't be too long. We just wanted to give people a quick introduction and basic sense of what Will and I will be covering on our 10-week class titled Understanding the Milk and Mammal Remedies. That's going to start on, let me find the correct date here. It's going to start in November. Yes, November 13th. And let me just tell people, I'll make another reminder at the end of the call, but just let people know that the super early bird special does end tomorrow. So if you still want to sign up, it's $225 for the 10-week session. That includes a full recording with all of the materials sent to you afterwards, fully edited. After tomorrow, the price will go up to $250. Also, there are still 8 spots for people to be enrolled in the drawing to win a $400 course, either a past course or a future course. So anyway, Will, why don't we just go ahead and get started? I thought maybe we could get started. I could ask you a couple of questions. When I first approached you about doing a class on the milk remedies, at first you said, well, I'm not sure. And then you kind of came back and said, well, if we do the milk and the mammals, you felt really good about the class. Maybe you could just share a little bit about what you're hoping to accomplish in the 10-week course, why you think maybe doing a class on milk and mammals might be of value to the students out there, and anything else you might want to share just to start off with.
Sure. Well, first off, the milks are an interesting group of remedies because we have solid, reliable information on a couple, and then fragments of information and a great deal of speculative information and modern derived information from contemporary approaches to perceiving the properties of substances on a number of others. And at first glance, looking at the milks, it looked like a very small collection of remedies to spend 10 weeks on in terms of how much can be really fully reliably said about them. But then we got a bunch of other really interesting remedies that are derived from mammals, other portions of mammals. We got some musks from the beaver and from the skunk, fascinating remedies from the little musk deer, Moschus, we have. And then we've got a variety of remedies that I think we won't include in this group that are kind of semi-mammalian derived. You know, a lot of the nosodes and sarcodes that are derived from particular tissues or from particular diseased tissues of mammals that are kind of interesting, although they kind of form a class of their own.
Well, I'm sorry to interject, but would you include ambergrisia as one of those which would be representative of a sarcode or nosode, or would you not consider it as such?
You know, that gets really problematic. And, in fact, if we look historically, we find that that Samuel Swan originally described lacconinum as a nosode. And actually, when we talk about lacconinum, there's actually an interesting discussion around that that I think is rather fascinating, that we'll definitely delve into. But, here with ambergrisia, this is a processed mucus secretion of sperm whales that, is passed through the gut and kind of solidified and washed up on beaches. I think it becomes a very interesting question of, do we call it, is it representative of whale, or is it representative of a pathological tissue or a normal tissue? And I think our definitions break down.
Do we even know if it's pathological or not? I mean, nobody's certain one way or the other. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, I don't know that we've, looked to see if sick whales or healthy whales make it. No. So our nice clean systems of classification kind of break down.
Yeah.
Here and become a little less useful. I think we can say the same thing about Moschus, which is a secretion of a gland. Do we call that a sarcode, or do we call that a do we not put it into that class or not?
Right.
So yeah.
Well, you know, Will, one of the things that motivated me to want to offer a class on milk and mammal remedies was that I recently had some very interesting cases. One was a lac phelinum case, and another was a lac leoninum case, both of which are doing very well at the moment.
I know, I'm wicked jealous of you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've been so classically oriented throughout my practice of homeopathy that I've largely overlooked, you know, some of the more contemporary, newly proven remedies. And, you know, I always reflect back to that famous quote by Schiller where he says, basically, if you're really interested in the truth, you have to be willing to accept some new information that maybe overthrows your entire paradigm or you know, current worldview. And, you know, I was seeing a number of patients. I was actually in Fiji traveling, and I had a large number of new cases that I was seeing over a fairly short period of time, and there were a few cases that came to me where literally none of the symptomology pictures, none of the complex of symptoms seemed to fit any of the remedies that I was particularly familiar with. And even after repertorizing and looking at a number of different remedies, I would have literally had to jam those cases to fit a particular remedy. And so I just kind of stepped outside of the box and began to look at some of these newer remedies, and lo and behold, lac phelinum and lac leoninum fit the two different cases very, very well. And I said, well, you know what? I'm not going to be prejudiced here. Let me go ahead and give it a shot and give these remedies. And sure enough, both patients had a very positive response. And it taught me a lesson that you have to be, you know, even after having practiced for many years and knowing the importance of being the unprejudiced observer and being unbiased, as Herring advocates so beautifully. That sometimes you get fixed into a particular rut and you can't see outside of it. And sure enough, here were two new remedies that seem to have a very positive effect, at least in the short term. It's still only 3-4 months into the process, but right now the response seems to be very quite positive. And also, I learned quite a bit about those two remedies. I had some understanding of them previously, but what was very interesting is that it began to allow me to think about the group of remedies in a different way as well, because I saw certain similarities that actually I have not found described in any of the feline remedies so far that seem to be found in both of the cases, and it didn't matter whether it was lion's milk or cat's milk. Now, of course, this is just two cases. I think it's somewhat premature to make any, you know, outright, statement of fact, but certainly we could speculate that there's some possibility that this might be a quality that doesn't run just to the individual remedies, but perhaps runs across the feline, and maybe with further cases we can confirm or, refute that particular proposition. But I guess we'll have to see. So that's where, you know, that for me was very exciting. In terms of yourself, Will, what are there any particular cases that come to mind that you're? I know you mentioned a few to me that you're particularly excited to present during the 10-week course.
Yeah, well, I've got a number of lac leoninum cases that it's a fascinating remedy. It's a remedy that I think we actually know. In terms of amount of information about it, know rather well. But, you know, you bring up a really interesting point, Kim, that applies to this, that one of the things that Herring did for us with his guiding symptoms was to take the proving symptoms, symptoms that were derived in the manner that Hahnemann suggested, you know, through experiments in healthy persons, but discuss those in the context of the clinical presentation in cases. And that's the real gem of the guiding symptoms is that he made clinical verification and placed these within clinical context. And one of the difficulties, of course, with a lot of contemporary remedies where we have provings and we've got, you know, listings of proving symptoms, we've got the proving records, is understanding what is the significance of that collection of symptoms in the clinical setting. And it's experiences like yours, you know, and seeing cases of it and saying, you know, now we can start to pull that together. We can start to say, now we can start to understand what this whole collection of symptoms means. How does, for example, you have a prover who says, I felt abandoned or whatever. And, you know, how does that actually play out in the clinical setting and relate to the larger constellation of symptoms? That we rarely get from the proving itself, and we gain that information from our clinical experience. So I think that's one of the things I'm hoping to do here is take a look at the cases and help them to clarify how these proving symptoms fall together into a more coherent whole.
I love what you just said, Will, because for me, this is really where the rubber hits the road. You know, you could read through, you know, Allen's keynotes or, you know, Lippe's red line symptoms or Herring's guiding symptoms. And, you know, you read one symptom after another, and then you realize that, like, every other remedy you ever read also lists, like, basically all those same symptoms. And you don't really have any sense of what makes this remedy distinct from any other remedy. And I think you're right. It's really through seeing the remedy act in clinical practice where you can see a live case and you can see how these symptoms actually manifest, how they're actually represented in a patient's life, that's where we begin to really have that deeper sense and deeper understanding of how the remedies actually present in real-life practice.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I think one of the things as a pedagogical exercise that I'd like to explore, and, you know, I like to do this really in all of our classes, this is what I like so much about teaching with you, Will, is that, you know, you bring such a depth of knowledge and clinical experience that, you know, we can go back and forth and have these very erudite discussions that I think teach both of us, you and me, not just the participants on the class, but both of us, a lot about homeopathy that we didn't realize before we started the class. And, you know, one of the things that I'd really like to explore, is, which it's talked about quite a bit, is that there are common themes, for example, for the milk remedies or common themes to the mammals. And I'd really like to enter the process of just exploring the validity or lack thereof of these various propositions.
Right. You know, and I think what happens is this gets confusing because oftentimes we hear people describe what these common themes might be, you know, to a group. And that information comes from a number of sources. For example, one is a speculative kind of source where we say, well, these are milks, and, you know, milks serve nourishment, and there's the withholding of milk and the giving of milk. So, you know, there must be, you know, in other words, we speculate that there must, you know, from this kind of what's today called often called source information,
right?
You know, or from proposed signatures, you know, we propose, well, it must have these issues of the withholding of nurture, or the giving of nurture, and so on. Or with lacaninum, you know, we speculate on the fate of a dog, and then we end up with a myth that I'm not going to spill the beans right now, but we know the dog that lacaninum came from, okay? And it's a very interesting story about that dog. But we end up with myths that aren't true, like it must have been an abused dog because this remedy has such a low self-esteem, and it's all that's the only piece of the beans I'll spill. It was not an abused dog.
Well, I mean, it's also true that different lac caninums come from different breeds of dog. Is that not correct?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and it brings up the question of where are our actual remedy source that we purchase. I know Robert Munz right now at Remedia in Austria is sourcing lac caninum. You can order any variety of lac caninum from him. He's got golden retriever, he's got Rottweiler, he's got wired hair dachshund, he's got pug. I had heard, and I don't see it on his listing, that he has Jack Russell Terrier. I want to see that one through. But you know. So anyway, we come up with this idea that you know these might be the themes that run through, or we also see a process of deriving themes that are sometimes gone through a process that some teachers are using where they're you know, looking in the repertory and saying, well, you know, I find 12 rubrics that describe forsakenness, you know, different aspects of forsakenness for this remedy, so it must be a huge theme for the remedy. And when we go back and look at the provings and the clinical experience, we find that maybe one prover said, I feel like my best friend's not calling me. And that goes, you know, that's slotted into a variety of rubrics, inflating the apparent importance of it. So, you know, I think what we need to do is this process that you're describing, both of carefully looking at the provings, but also carefully weighing that against clinical experience and building up any themes like this empirically from those experiences, and testing that against the proposed themes that come from suggestion of signature or source or whatever else. I think it's a fascinating process to go through, and sometimes we get surprised about our remedies, and so.
I just want to say, Will, this is really what I appreciate about working with you, is that, you know, you keep an open mind, but you don't lose that scientific rigor, which is so necessary to, you know, to separate the wheat from the chaff. Because otherwise, you know, people go around and they say whatever they want, and there's not necessarily even any clinical cases to support their statements. And then you have just hundreds of different things being proposed out there, and some of which have no validity whatsoever. So I really appreciate the fact that you are open-minded, that you embrace the new ideas that are being put forward in homeopathy, but at the same time, you maintain a critical eye and an ability to really look at things scientifically and make those distinctions.
I was discussing with a student the other day, and I was critiquing some suggestions that are contemporary, that have kind of crept into contemporary teachings, and, you know, kind of I not being so arrogant as to say these are wrong, but actually I was. No, but I was trying to do it in an exploratory way with him, and saying, well, you know, let's look into this, let's think about this. And, you know, but realizing that as a homeopath, I'm prescribing remedies that are diluted beyond Avogadro's number. So I have to be pretty careful about being overly critical of anything.
No, it's true, you know. So listen, Will, you know, you mentioned earlier on about there's some milk remedies that we have a fairly, well, good knowledge of, you know, like lac caninum and difluron. There's some out there that we have some, you know, reasonably good knowledge, and then there's some that we have just a beginner's level of knowledge, and then there's some for which we don't even necessarily know what the remedy is, like lac primatum or, you know, some of these more unusual, the ape's milk remedy. We don't even know what the source is, actually.
Sure. Or you know, I was in England last year, and somebody was presenting cases of African tiger's milk.
African tiger's milk. Which, do you want to tell them what the problem with that is, Will, so that what you're getting to?
The problem with that is that the only tigers in Africa are in zoos. There are no tigers in Africa.
Yeah.
So I was rather inappropriate with him, but I was asking him, what's the source of your remedy? I mean, where do you get this from? And he really couldn't tell me anything more than it was from an African tiger, which may have been from a zoo in Nairobi or something. I don't know, you know. But
you know, Will, you should have been thankful he wasn't talking about a case of a snake milk remedy, you know.
Or owl's milk.
But, you know, earlier you said this thing about, you know, the different level of knowledge we have, and I think this is very interesting because I know you're aware of the fact that when Kent wrote about lac caninum, he literally said that he felt it was going to be a very promising remedy, but that it would literally be 100 years, a century, before we had any real knowledge of how to use lac caninum in practice. And I think, you know, that he wrote that like in, you know, 1880 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's over 100 years ago. Now lac caninum is a remedy we understand quite well. But then there are these new remedies that have appeared, and essentially they represent for us what lac caninum represented for Kent in 1880.
And it was very interesting because, you know, this problem of new remedies, are we going to use them, you know, for example, using lac salinum for you, Kim, isn't at all new.
It's proven by Swan, isn't it, originally?
Well, Samuel Swan sponsored the provings, but many others were, like, for example, Adolf Lippe was involved in generating some of the proving information on this remedy. So, you know, Swan was regarded as a bit of a renegade in that day, but Lippe, of course, was, he was kind of, you know, about as
highly
Panamanian as you can get. But what's very interesting is the proving information for lac caninum was not accepted by Timothy Allen. If you look in the Encyclopedia Pura Materia Medica, you'll find it's not in there. And there's a very interesting letter trail back and forth between Timothy Allen, who'd collected all the provings, and Samuel Swan about why Alan was not accepting it, and Swan being rather irate about it and writing him back and da-da-da-da, and Alan making various excuses like, I don't see a coherency in the symptom patterns, you know, describing. It doesn't look like a legitimate proving. And at other times, you know, coming back and saying it's kind of a disgusting substance and a ridiculous substance to introduce. And at other times, apparently just singling out Swan as perhaps an unreliable contributor. So, you know, these issues we have today with accepting lackey quinum or lion's milk or whatever is a remedy are just paralleling this.
Yeah. Well, you know, Divya Chabra conducted a proving of, I know you know this, of lack selenium. I'm curious, have you found any value in that more current proving relative to some of the prior provings of lack selenium?
You know, I'm going to learn from your case of lack selenium, Kim.
Okay.
I've not successfully, I believe I prescribed it once, not successfully. So it's a remedy that I don't understand, and I think I'll help come to.
Well,
on the other hand, some of the remedies, like equinum, horse's milk.
Yeah.
Is
that's the Nancy Herrick proving.
Hopefully, I'm offering. I'm very skeptical of some of those provings. And here's why. I think because Nancy brings her, she believes in this notion of synchronicity. So, you know, we should do the lack equinum proving with thoughts of horses in our mind and so on. And my concern is, well, that brings the folk process into proving symptomatology and perhaps pollutes what we know about this remedy. And so it's a remedy I was very, very cautious of and suspicious of. And yet, certainly, even if folk process and projection influence that proving, certainly there are real, genuine, and reliable proving symptoms within that as well. And it's a remedy that I have used successfully. Kicking and screaming, I was very upset with myself. With it because it didn't feel like, you know, it felt like I was kind of stepping out of the realm of reliable information. But
you know, lack equinum is an interesting one, Will. I did actually quite a bit of study on lack equinum a number of years ago because I remember actually meeting with Nancy over dinner with her husband Roger, and we were talking about her provings. I don't know if you know, but actually Mickey edited her first proving book on. Not the first one, but the second one on the animal remedies.
And
for people who know, Mickey's my wife. And I remember at the time she told me that she thought that lack equinum would become a polycrest remedy based on the number of successes she had had in her own practice. And so it really struck me when she said that, and I actually did quite a bit of study. This was years ago. But I can honestly say I've never seen a case so far, and, you know, that doesn't mean anything really, but so far I haven't had the opportunity to prescribe it. So you as well have not seen any cases or have not found it in any of the cases that you've
seen? No, with lack equinum, I've had some very interesting successful cases.
Uh-huh.
And I found it's a remedy that, you know, I can potentially confuse with falcon and with salmon. Jeremy Scherer's salmon comes in and bears some resemblances. It's I would suggest a rather tubercular remedy with, you know, strong discontent, the desire for change and intolerance of injustice and so on. And very interesting remedy. I think one that might speak to some of the tubercular pathologies of today. You know, it's an interesting thing. Hahnemann included scrofula and phthisis within his descriptions of, you know, tubercular expressions within his description of sora. And I think that was possible because in his day, you know, tuberculosis was kind of in-your-face acute. Not a lot of accumulated chronic tubercular disease in his day, and yet today we see so much. I think it's not a degradation of the world, but it's one of those cyclic shifts of things that we see so much more tubercular pathology today. And I would suggest that a lot of these lack remedies, a lot of these milk remedies are very tubercular in that manner, and maybe are coming into their own today, and that they address some of these tubercular pathologies that we see so much more of now than we may have in the 19th century.
Interesting. You know, Will Kent wrote in his lectures on homeopathic materia medica when he was writing about lactinium, he wrote that all the milks should be potentized, that they were like the most excellent remedies, that they were animal products and foods of early animal life, and that therefore they would correspond to the beginnings of our innermost physical nature. Do you have any comments on that particular statement of his?
That's interesting, isn't it?
I've wrestled with that one for quite a while myself. I'm curious if you had any thoughts about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kent was a funny bugger, wasn't he?
He was.
You know, he's a very bright man, very good homeopath. He had a lot of so much Swedenborgian philosophy. You know, he was so enamored with Swedenborg that he brought in a lot of that kind of worldview. That I think sometimes gets rather confusing with how much of Kant's philosophy was derived from his homeopathic experience and how much of it derived from his speculative Swedenborgian worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. You always have to take his philosophical statements, I think, with a grain of salt, because you're right, there's so much influenced by Swedenborg's philosophy.
Yeah. And it's very interesting, you know, to compare what Kant wrote or, you know, actually lectured on, and because it was his students who recorded it, you know, for example, in the philosophies, lectures on philosophy, to compare that with reading his recorded cases.
Oh, it's so true, isn't it?
And seeing the difference, or looking at his lectures on materia medica and saying, you know, I wonder how much of his philosophy may have been haughty for him and not directly tied to his actual practice.
You're so right about that, Will, because there's so many of his cases where you can see that he literally prescribed almost exclusively on physical symptomology, and yet you get the sense in his philosophical writings that the mind is, you know, the supreme thing upon which we prescribe. And
Right. And, you know, that really distorts Hahnemann's comments on the subject. You know,
sure.
Look at what Hahnemann wrote in the Organon about the mind. I think we can construe it if we force it in that way, but I think that very much comes from the Swedenborgian idea that all of the material world filters in from the metaphysical through the mind of man, and that literally for Kent, okay, the mind of man, not the mind of woman or the mind of animal. You know?
Mind of man, you're right. It's true.
And, you know, filters in through the mind of man, and then, you know, then materializes into the physical world. This is Swedenborgian thought, and yet I think, you know, Hahnemann was saying these mental emotional symptoms are so important because, well, they're there. And he was doing, I suspect, why am I blanking on the term I'm looking for? But I think he was trying to emphasize the importance of mental emotional in the wholeness of disease, because in his day, there was a very strict mind-body divide. The whole idea that mental illness and physical illness had anything to do with each other was just not part of the medicine of his day at all. And so he had to do affirmative action. He had to do some affirmative action for the mind,
right,
you know, in emphasizing its role, because the physicians of his day had no room for the mind in physical disease. Today, you know, I find myself teaching naturopaths, and I don't have to emphasize the role of mental emotional in the physical realm. They know that. Sometimes we need to go back and emphasize the physical, the somatic, because we sometimes ignore it in prioritizing the mind.
You know, Will, you mentioned earlier about, and I think I also said something to the effect that There are these books being written that talk about themes that run across various groupings. You know, they talk about, you know, the themes of the Solanacea or the Primulaceae or Umbelliferae or, you know, any of these taxonomical or, you know, other types of grouping snakes. And, of course, the same thing has crept into the literature about the lack in milk remedies and also mammal remedies and animal remedies in general. And I was just curious, one of the things that's commonly attributed to the lack remedies is this issue of being disappointed, that the person who needs a lack remedy is very oftentimes dependent on somebody who they love very deeply, somebody, you know, like a parent or somebody they're married to or even a friend in some cases. And then something happens and a deep disappointment settles in and they're literally unable to bear it. I find that interesting because one reason I find it interesting is because you won't find any of the lack remedies listed under ailments from just being disappointed or even any of the sub-rubrics. But this seems to be the clinical experience of a number of different practitioners. I'm curious, in your practice, with the lack remedies that you've given, have you found this to be much of an issue, or could you speak to it in general?
No, I have not. I haven't. And we get into trouble this way, don't we? Because we can see a case where you say, oh, the major theme of this point is disappointment of the person that you are dependent upon. And then we say, oh, so now we're going to lock ourselves into the lacks and let's decide which lack, you know, which milk we need, and perhaps entirely miss the possibility of this being, you know, or pulsatilla or, you know,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
We have the risk of closing our mind off to those remedies that aren't described within that, quote, theme. Large part. No, I haven't. And in fact, when we talk about lack caninum, there are a lot of pieces like this. There are a lot of projections from what we believe dogs are like. Not only the disappointment, but the dependency on others. For example, there are people who describe lack caninum and say that loyalty is a very important part of this remedy, and yet that's just not an aspect of that remedy at all.
It's not in the proving at all, is it?
No, it's not, and it's not been there in my clinical experience.
Yeah, I can't say that I've seen that either.
Yeah,
it's for me the other issue too, Will, is just disappointment is such a universal human emotion. I mean, who doesn't have disappointment on some level? I mean, this just kind of seems to be implicit in the human condition. So just to use the word disappointment without any reference to any particular type of disappointment or it being the center of that person's life, it seems to me that you can make anything fit into that because it's, like I said, everybody's got disappointment on some level.
Well, you know, it is one of the difficulties in trying to rely on, quote, themes, unquote, in working with remedies because, by definition, they're going to be large nets, right? The theme will be a large net.
No SRPs, no stranger and peculiars.
What's that?
No strangeware and peculiars, no aphorism 153 symptoms.
Right, and you know, when a patient comes in the office and they sit down and you say, tell me about your life, and they say, well, I have a lot of disappointment in my life, you know. I probably haven't started writing yet because what I need to do is say, tell me about that, okay, or just tell me, because what I want to know is, there's disappointment is a broad stroke, and what I'm interested in is, what is it that has disappointed you? How has it? What is your reaction to that?
Right.
What's the terrain of disappointment? Sometimes I'll use questions like, you know, if you couldn't use the word disappointed, if I were to deny you that, or I'm from Mars and I don't know what the word disappointment means, or, you know, variations on this. Tell me what you're talking about, you know. And one of the things that I am very surprised with, not anymore, but it was very surprising to me as I started doing homeopathy, was I thought I understood how people thought. And I'm reminded of Hahnemann's line in The Medical Observer where he says, how does he phrase it? He says something like, you need to distrust your impressions.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. It's like the third paragraph or something. Yeah.
So, you know, they say I'm disappointed, and they say, tell me about that. And they come up with a description of this, and I go, oh, that's a disappointment. Huh, what do you know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's my inner thought. It would never have occurred to me that that's something that someone would use the word disappointment to describe. So, you know, we have to be cautious sometimes about using these broad strokes in our understanding of remedies.
So, Will, having said that, have you found, I know you've, because we spoke about this earlier, and you mentioned that you've prescribed a number of different LAC remedies and, of course, mammal remedies of various types, you know, in your lengthy career as a homeopath. Have you found any common threads that seem to run through the LACs or the mammals or not?
Well, you know, we'll kind of come to that as we go through individuals, but you know, if we are to pull out one, I think a general discontent, not only with the world, but a discontent with oneself, is a piece that I think comes up.
So almost like a type of antagonism or something? Is that what you're...
Yeah, with oneself and with the world in general.
Mm-hmm.
Wanting things to be different. You know, we find that manifest in like equanim with a strong, strong sense of awareness of injustice, for example, and discontent with how the world's constructed in that manner.
So this is why you're feeling that the lacs have a strong tubercular diathesis associated with it.
Yeah. Well, this is just one part of many.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the other thing, of course, is you know, tubercular disease. You know, Chaudhry talks about this, and I was amazed when I saw it, I go, oh, yes, you know, is that tubercular disease tends to be asymmetric, somatically, tends to express on one side or the other, and or alternate sides. And we see this very strongly in the LAC remedies, where we see somatic symptomatology express unilaterally or alternate or you know, strongly on one side or the other. As we see in you know, other strongly tubercular remedies like glycosis or pulsatilla.
So, Will, I want to give people an opportunity to ask some questions as well. I'd like to open up the lines. But before I do that, could you just give us all a sense of what remedies you think you might... I know you're not bound to this, and
yeah,
you might certainly interject other remedies. I know that throughout the courses that we've done together, we've said that we're going to cover 20 remedies. We probably end up covering 45 or 50 remedies every time because there's all these differentials to do.
Sure.
And other remedies that are outside of the grouping that are important to compare. But are there any particular remedies that you're hoping to cover during the 10-week course?
Sure. Well, of course, part of this, Kim, is that you and I need to do a little mud wrestling
because
I'm going to grab some before you do, and you know, I got my favorites, and you know, so you can, you know, so I'll throw some out, but I want you to know, Kim, that
no, you know what, Will,
we want some of these.
We're all good now.
Those of you who are listening, I just tease Kim and I just love working with Kim, and we tend to work out things pretty well, so we're not really going to fight each other, bruise any noses about this. Definitely LAC caninum is their best known of the milks, and I've got a lot of interesting clinical experience with it. Fun remedy to work with, LAC defloratum. And actually the other LAC bovinums, the other cow's milks, are kind of interesting to look at along with LAC defloratum. You know why we have LAC defloratum is because when Swan tried to succuss whole milk, he ended up with butter. So, so he later decided that he later ended up preparing, you know, triturated cream. And,
right. And, yeah, that's a remedy as well. The Foss is the cream. Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, the LAC bovinums there with LAC defloratum is the central remedy of that. Mephitis is a remedy that I really have a lot of fun with.
For people who don't know, that's Mephites.
Yeah. Do you know Julian's Winston story about Mephites, Kim?
No. For people who don't know, Julian Winston was a very great historian of homeopathy who passed away, I don't know, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And, yeah, go ahead and share the story, Will. I haven't heard it.
So you know, Mephites is the musk of the skunk. And they were cleaning out the old Burkean, was it the Burkean Toffel facility in Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm.
They were closing it out and open it up, and folks going in and salvaging stuff. And Julian went in and pulled out a gallon bottle of a 1X tincture of Mephitis. You know, it's a 1 to 10 dilution of skunk stuff, right? in a glass jar. And he moved it to New Zealand.
Oh, my God. And he was able to get across the border and everything, huh? Unbelievable.
I'm thinking, can you imagine that?
Yeah, well, yeah, what do you say? These days, you never get away with it.
I know. Did you see snakes on a plane? Can you imagine if that jar was broken?
That's an unbelievable story.
So anyway, Mephitis is a very fascinating remedy. Castoreum, the musk of beaver.
I actually have an interesting case of castoreum where I used it.
Really?
Yeah, for a woman who became, it wasn't her chronic remedy, but it was she had gone through a kind of debilitating illness, long-term infectious condition, and when she was convalescing, she kind of got very emotional. She was kind of almost in a state of hysteria, and the castoreum calmed her down tremendously.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. That's a neat remedy. Now, I think you've taught Moschus already, haven't you?
I taught Moschus, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We probably wouldn't do that unless you know, Will, you have another really good case. I had a very good case of it, but if you another case, we can certainly introduce that.
We might do it in passing with castoreum, you know, just as kind of a nice contrast and
sure.
comparison and a very similar remedy in many respects. And I think have you also done ambergrisia?
I believe I did teach a very nice case of ambergrisia,
I think we can bring ambergrisia in again because it's a fascinating remedy. It's a big remedy, and there's a lot to be said about it. And probably having you talked about it, hearing me talk about it, we're going to come up with more wholeness rather than more repetition in it. So that'd be fair.
I just want to say that I appreciate what you just said, Will, because I don't want people to think that if, you know, we covered a remedy in another class, now we're not going to be doing the same remedies that we've ever done in any other class, but just because we reference or even do a case of another of the same remedy that was presented previously doesn't mean that it won't be of incredible value to the participants, because as Will said, it doesn't just add more information, it creates a greater sense of wholeness and a deeper understanding of that remedy. And that's really what is required, is that depth of understanding, so that when a patient who requires that remedy comes into your office, you're able to recognize that state clearly. Even if the disease condition is different and the symptoms aren't quite exactly the same, you're able to see that underlying completeness that constitutes the remedy itself.
You know, to that end, Kim, one of the things I like to use as an example of that is the last new case that I took in Maine before I closed my practice to move out here was a woman. It was a difficult case. I labored a long time in the analysis of it, and it was a pulsatilla case. You know, a remedy you'd think you could prescribed blindfolded backwards, and she came in. She was in angular dress for success, black and white business clothes. She was lean. She had high cheekbones. You know, she was obviously very physically fit and exercised regularly and talked about that. She was a mid-level manager making her way up the corporate ladder with 30 men working beneath her in the business she was with. And, you know, any superficial prescription, you know, you'd kind of immediately start thinking, you know, Nixtamaca, Sepia, Lilium Tigrinum, these kinds of, you know, remedies for somebody like this. And it was very interesting going through her case. You know, finally, about 45 minutes into the case, I kind of leaned forward and looked at her and says, "What is it you really want?" And she, all of a sudden, her whole demeanor softened, like her whole face, all the angles went out of it, and she started crying, and she said, "I just want Jesus to rock me in his lap." You know, so, I mean, the point is that our remedies don't always come to us with the familiar wrappings on them, and sometimes it's very interesting to see, for example, in a case like this, what happens to somebody who needs pulsatilla, who has never been nurtured in their life, and doesn't know what it's like, so can't identify that it's what makes them feel good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I actually had a pulsatilla case recently, too, where many different things didn't point to pulsatilla, but when you really went deeply into the case, you could see that basically it was a case of pulsatilla. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, one of the videos I like to illustrate, run aside on pulsatilla for a moment, which is not a milk, but it has nurture and lack of nurture. What's the movie with, oh my God, why am I blanking right now? It's a guy in the Navy who gets into a lot of fights, and his psychiatrist is okay. Wow. So I should have known what I was talking about before I started this story.
Is it an older film, Will? Or,
no, you know, it's probably about 8 years old, and it's
I probably don't know it, but anyway.
anyway, I will think of it. But it's a great example of you watching it through, and you don't know this is pulsatilla until you get to the pancake scene with all the butter. Someone knows that movie. They can tell us when we open up the phone line.
Okay, sounds good. Well, let's go ahead and open up the lines and let some people ask some questions. Let me just emphasize that I'm very excited personally about this course. I'm always excited to co-teach these types of courses with Dr. Taylor because, as I mentioned earlier, he brings just a tremendous level of knowledge, personal life wisdom, intelligence, discrimination, and huge amount of clinical practice. I mean, he is the head of the homeopathy department at National College of Naturopathic Medicine. He oversees, you know, the whole clinic there, and therefore he sees, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cases monthly, or I don't know, yearly, whatever, but many, many cases, and he brings this knowledge in a very generous way to these courses. And as you can see from our discussion, this will not be a static, you know, just here's the information, here's the symptoms of this remedy, and this is what you should look. We will literally be having a dialogue with each other and with the audience, and through that process of dialogue, we're hoping to bring out and elucidate what is really important about these remedies so that we can all have a deeper and better understanding and be better able to prescribe them in practice and therefore consequently really improve our overall success. So for me personally, this is a journey that I'm excited to take. It will be extremely multimedia rich. Both Dr. Taylor and I are committed to producing very high quality materials. All of those materials are made available, all the cases, all the repertorizations, all of the PowerPoints and slides are made available. And all of this is recorded both on audio and video formats. And after the course ends, they are edited, and then we send out to all of the participants a video and audio recording of the entire 10-week course. Again, let me just say that the course is starting on November 13th. It will run for 10 weeks. There'll be a break for Thanksgiving on November 24th. Currently, the price of the early bird special is $225. That expires tomorrow evening, and then it goes up to $250. And also, there are still 8 spots for somebody to win a course, either one of the prior courses or one of the future courses that we're offering. So with that, Will, did you want to add anything before I open up the lines?
No, except I'm about to come up with a film.
Okay, great. All right, so let me open up, and if anybody has any questions for Dr. Taylor or myself, they're welcome to go ahead and ask them.
So the film was Antoine Fisher. There we go. Okay.
Oh, great. So, thanks, Will.
Okay, guys.
We got about 8-9 minutes here for anybody who's got questions about the lack remedies, mammal remedies, homeopathy in general, the course, whatever you'd like.
Yeah. Your website says that the course begins on October 13th. Could you clarify the start date?
You're right. It's October. Is that correct? October 13th? Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I made a mistake. October 13th. You're correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Any other questions?
So it'll be consistently Wednesday nights?
It will be. It'll be every Wednesday from on West Coast 5 to 7 p.m. If you're on the East Coast, it'll run from 8 to 10 p.m.
Great.
Yeah. Sometimes we go a little bit over, but we try to keep it within the 2 hours. Will is notorious for going over and giving more information and going like 2 hours and 15 or 20 minutes. That's all.
Yeah, I don't know when to stop.
That works for me.
Wait.
What's that? Yeah, I know. We've never had a complaint about you going over yet.
Oh, good. Okay.
I really like you out there.
Okay.
Any other questions that we can answer for anybody? Okay, well, listen, thank you, everybody, for participating in tonight's session. We hope that you were able to glean some useful gems from Dr. Taylor and myself about the milk and mammal remedies and just maybe some other ideas about homeopathy. Again, we look at this course as an opportunity to explore together, you know, homeopathy, and in this case specifically the milk and the mammal remedies. And we're excited to have all of you participate and look forward to joining you. So, Will, with that, I'm going to just say thank you to everybody. And, Will, thank you for taking the time out to join us this evening. And hopefully we'll see a lot of you on the call in October.